To the end, Maurice Sendak retained a wicked sense of humor, which he demonstrated this past January when comedian Stephen Colbert paid him a visit.
Why write for children?
I don't write for children.
You don't?
No, I write. And somebody says, that's for children. I didn't set out to make children happy or make life better for them or easier for them.
Do you like them?
I like them as few and far between as I do adults. Maybe a bit more because I really don't like adults at all.
Let me just get that. Maurice Sendak, children,
Writer Gregory Maguire has had a lot of chances to witness that humor. He's a longtime friend of Maurice Sendak, has written books for adults and children, and paid tribute to Sendak as a writer and illustrator in his book Making Mischief, A Maurice Sendak Appreciation. Gregory Maguire, thanks for being with us, and thanks for talking to us on this tough day.
Oh, it's a sad day, but I'm glad to talk with you about my dear friend.
Let me ask you about that humor that we just heard. That was just a couple of months ago. And all through this interview, Maurice Sendak is completely matching Stephen Colbert joke for joke. In fact, maybe outshining Stephen Colbert in the humor department.
Oh, I think he was running circles around Colbert. I think Maurice did have a little bit of Borscht Belt in him, or a little bit of the black side of what black comedy really means. He knew that life was rough. It was rough for children, and it was rough for citizens, and it was rough for loners. And if you don't laugh at it, you're cooked.
I want to talk to you a little bit about Maurice Sendak as a mentor, which I understand he was to you and a number of other younger writers. And he talked about that kind of relationship back in 2005 in an interview with NPR's Jennifer Ludden. Let's take a listen.
This big gorilla head that's stuffed full of experience, I want to give it away before I'm gone. I want to give it away to young artists who are as vehement and passionate about their lives and work as I was and am.
You've just said you can't really write for children. So
no.
what do you tell
them? I teach them how not to write for children, although they come here to learn how to write for children. But I'm freeing them of that incubus of, don't think about that.
Gregory Maguire, do you remember those words from Maurice Sendak coming to you?
I remember having lunch with him once in South Hadley, Massachusetts, and he said, Gregory, if you ever sell out, I will come back from the grave and I will sit at the edge of your bed and I will taunt you. You remember, children are the most important thing. You keep their welfare at the heart of everything that you do, or I will come back. So now I'm tempted to tease him to see, will you really, Maurice? I'd love to see you again. How can I get you back?
And what did he want you to remember about children?
Well, you know, that clip that you had about he didn't write for children, he didn't care about children. Well, that was a lot of baloney. Of course, he loved children because they are a pure repository of the human spirit. But it wasn't baloney in this way. He wrote books that were published for children, but anybody who read them when they were young found that, unlike most other books, they were not put aside in the attic as one grew older. The books that I'd read of his when I was 8 and 10 and 12, maybe, seemed actually to say more to me the older that I got. They were real works of art. They are real works of art, because the more you look at them, the less you understand how they do what they do, that wonderful magic.
What's the mystery there for you as you look at them now?
He was a poet of comedy and a poet of transformations. All his stories are about children transforming themselves out of the gloom of difficult circumstances into maybe not paradise, maybe not salvation, but into a slightly better situation where they could at least take the next meal and move on to the next hurdle.
Gregory, I understand that you were with Maurice Sendak in the hospital just before he died. And this is someone who was really obsessed with his own mortality, really, I think, since childhood. He talked about it quite a bit.
He did, and he railed against having to lose anything that was valuable and precious. But he had always faced directly and squarely and with great courage anything that was difficult. He taught children to face it in his books. He taught the adults who were inspired by his books to face it in their own work. And what I brought into the hospital room was a photograph I recently purchased of Lewis Carroll, Lewis Carroll of Alice in Wonderland. Mm-hmm. He's sitting on the edge of an open window with his feet on the outside of it, as if he's trying to escape the constrictions of a difficult, strict Victorian life. And he has Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass ahead of him in his life to make. I brought this because Maurice felt that he was intimately related. He was relative to people like Emily Dickinson and Keats and Henry James and Homer. He felt that they were his friends and part of his family. Oh, he would plump up the pillow for them. He would say, "Emily Dickinson, come put your head down beside mine as I read some of your poetry as I drift off to sleep tonight." Mm. So I brought him Lewis Carroll so I could say, "Lewis Carroll is over there. He's on the other side of the glass, Maurice. He's ready to welcome you so that you can lean down and you can be a family member of us. You're gone. Your books aren't gone. Your influence isn't gone. Make sure to come back and haunt us."
I've been talking with Gregory Maguire, author of the novel Wicked and many others, remembering his friend Maurice Sendak, who died today at age 83. Gregory Maguire, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The television anchor Rachel Maddow has been arguing that we're looking at America's wars the wrong way. More properly, Maddow contends we're not really paying attention at all. Maddow of MSNBC contends that most American civilians were not asked to sacrifice at all as U.S. troops fought in Iraq and Afghanistan.
We gave ourselves a giant tax cut before 9/11. We were attacked on 9/11. We went to Afghanistan. We did not debate giving back that tax cut. Then 2 years later, we were thinking about starting a second simultaneous war in Iraq. We gave ourselves another round of tax cuts and then started the second simultaneous war. Those are not the actions of a country that feels that it is sacrificing alongside its men and women in uniform. And that divide, I think, Americans feel emotionally, and I'd like that emotional divide to become defined as a political problem that we should solve.
Rachel Maddow makes that argument in a book called Drift. She contends that after past American wars, from the Revolution to World War II, the U.S. drastically cut back its military when peace arrived. Now she says we have a more permanent military, which seems to be sent perpetually into conflict somewhere.
The drawdown that we've had after conflicts have ended over time, the drawdown has become less and less dramatic. There was a drawdown after the Cold War. I think that we are going to see shrinkage now, already starting to see shrinkage now in the military as we wind down the war in Afghanistan and as we have ended the war in Iraq. But starting after Vietnam, in particular, the drawdown has been less and less. And so we've ended up with a larger force than we had before the thing that we built up for.
Is that really a bad thing? I mean, I think about the fact that, yeah, after World War II, the United States practically dismantled the army. And then a few years later, they got into the Korean War. And thousands of Americans died because they really weren't ready for that conflict.
Military preparedness is absolutely a form of strength. And how we maintain that is, again, something, though, that needs to be considered, I think, in the broader form of all different kinds of American strength. We're doing some things with our military superstructure that I think are leftovers, in part because military resources don't have to compete with non-military resources. Pentagon dollars are essentially seen as a different kind of funding that doesn't have to stand for itself and make an argument for itself in the halls of Congress.
Are you suggesting that part of the reason that we've been at war for a decade is not just because we were attacked, but because we had a large military so we could, and so we've used it?
I think that we have looked around the world, found foreign policy problems, and looked for military solutions to those problems because that's the best tool we had to address those things. I think that when you look at the expansion of the mission in Afghanistan and in Iraq, when you look at what the justification was, I mean, in Iraq, awkwardly, the justification was weapons of mass destruction that were not there. Once we had gone, though, ultimately, by the time we left, what we were trying to do was establish Iraq as a democratic ally of the United States in the Middle East. I think the military, as proud and capable as it is, I think the idea that the military can build new countries is a tall order. And it's the sort of thing that we would only expect from a military that we had super resourced and thought of as super capable.
You know, it's interesting. In your book, you quote Thomas Jefferson, who is one of the founding fathers who spoke about the dangers of a large military. And I found that interesting because this is a guy who I think is more often quoted by conservatives. I mean, he's the ultimate proponent of limited government. Did you find any irony in the fact that you find yourself drawn to Thomas Jefferson, arguing for a smaller government here?
Less irony than the fact that Roger Ailes blurbed the book. Roger Ailes from Fox News blurbed the book
and said it was a good read.
No, I mean, I sort of did that on purpose. I mean, when you're looking to the founding fathers to talk about their concerns about making war too much, that was a really animating thing going on for the founding fathers. I mean, they were very upset about what was going on with the British Empire and the British king. And there's a reason that the quartering soldiers thing, which seems so random, is foundational in our founding documents. You do try to pick people in order to, I think, attract attention across the aisle, to constantly sort of make the point, listen, this isn't a partisan thing. Even if you hate me because I'm a liberal, you may still find some worth in this argument.
Although Jefferson is such a funny example to choose on this issue, because he was a big proponent of limited government until he actually became president of the United States, and then used a lot of power, including looking over and realizing he still had a navy, and he sent it over to whack a bunch of Barbary pirates. I mean, he went to war.
In that, he is a perfect example of the way that presidents adapt to the idea of executive power. I mean, if you look at our current president, as a constitutional law professor and as somebody who was, I think, reacting to the imperial presidency style excesses of the George W. Bush administration, I mean, President Obama opined beautifully on the radical expansion of executive power and how he did not think that was right for the country and it was ahistorical and all these other things. But I defy you to find any part of executive power that President Obama has yielded since he has been there.
It also seems that you're suggesting that he's basically doing what presidents do. It's the office that, in the end, shapes the situation, shapes the person.
I think that presidents don't give up power that has accrued to them by the precedent of previous presidents. Even when they say they would like to, I think once they get there, they don't give it up. And I think that's why the founding fathers didn't put the specific power of waging war in the hands of the president, because they knew that the temptation would be too great, that human nature, what it is with good presidents and bad, you would end up with more wars than you needed as a country if one man could essentially make the decision about whether we wage the wars. And so knowing that Congress was going to be much more unwieldy in making that decision, they, with studied care, put that decision in the hands of Congress.
But are you suggesting that if the political system doesn't change, that really, we're just going to be set up to get ourselves into more conflicts? We're going to find more conflicts as quickly as we get out of the old ones.
Yeah, I do think that is what's going on. And there's an important caveat, which is that all the efforts to insulate the American public from the cost of war so that we don't notice, so that a state of war is normal, all of those insulating efforts fail a little bit, because I think there is a core American emotional value to the idea that our military shouldn't be secret, that our military shouldn't be separate from us, that people who fight in our name shouldn't be people other than us. And the idea of waging war constantly makes us uncomfortable enough that I think that it's becoming politically impossible to keep up this pace. I think the debate about whether or not there should be intervention in Syria is affected by that. I think the debate about whether or not we ought to start another war in Iran is affected by that. I think the debate about what we ought to do in Libya was affected by that. I think the American people are uncomfortable with where we have landed. And I think that politicians who pay attention to that will not only reap electoral rewards, but I think they will find that if they start pushing on this issue, they're going to get far. It's going to be pushing on an open door. People want this to change.
Rachel Maddow is the author of Drift. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
When Hilary Mantel's new book opens, the spark has gone out of Henry VIII's marriage, second marriage, in fact. Anne Boleyn hasn't given him a son. Now he finds the sharp remarks she makes that used to charm sometimes come at his expense. His roving eye begins to settle on Jane Seymour, another woman at court, but in Henry's time, a monarch doesn't go to a marriage counselor or divorce lawyer, not when Thomas Cromwell is the king's chief adviser. Bring Up the Bodies is Hilary Mantel's latest novel, the sequel to Wolf Hall, which won the Man Booker Prize and worldwide acclaim, and latest in a planned trilogy about Thomas Cromwell. Historically, Cromwell's considered a dangerous and unscrupulous bully, but in Hilary Mantel's books, he, like any other man, is more than his reputation. We meet Cromwell in the fall of 1535.
Thomas Cromwell is now about 50 years old. He has a labourer's body, stocky, useful, running to fat. His black hair, greying now. He never spares himself in the king's service. He knows his worth and merits, and makes sure of his reward. Offices, perquisites and title deeds, manor houses and farms. He has a way of getting his way. He has a method. He will charm a man or bribe him, coax him or threaten him. He will explain to a man where his true interests lie, and he will introduce that same man to aspects of himself he didn't know existed. Every day, Master Secretary deals with grandees who, if they could, would destroy him with one vindictive swipe, as if he were a fly. Knowing this, he's distinguished by his courtesy, his calmness, and his indefatigable attention to England's business.
Wow. What a wonderful depiction of a human being, Miss Mantel.
Thank you.
And I guess that's the point. He's a human being. You've taken a character known from portraits and, in a sense, caricature.
He's a work in progress, as far as I'm concerned. I'm far from being able to add him up. I'm not even trying at this point. I seem to have set the mechanism ticking, and now I'm standing back and I'm watching. Some people said to me, when you wrote Wolf Hall, the first Thomas Cromwell book, that was his rise and the next volume will be his fall, right? But actually, it's not like that at all. He will go on and on rising in the world till he becomes Earl of Essex. And then his fall, when it came in 1540, was very, very sudden. In a few weeks, it was all over.
Does Cromwell humor or flatter his monarch?
Cromwell knows how to work him. And his method, as he explains it to the reader, is give way, give way, give way on every point until you reach the one point where you must stick and then take your stand. Because in the end, Henry needs to be told the truth and he needs someone strong who can stand up to him. Otherwise, it will be like an animal. If you back away and back away, he will just hunt you down.
What drew Henry to Jane Seymour?
It wasn't love at first sight. Henry had known her for a long time. But contemporaries said maybe it's because she is such a contrast to Anne Boleyn. Anne was flamboyant and beautiful. She was sexy and she knew how to work life her way. Jane was muted. She was soft. A complete opposite sort of woman, meek and demure. Someone who would say, yes, Henry, no, Henry. In Jane, he saw the woman who would reflect him back at twice his size.
There's a fascinating section in the middle of the story where Cromwell wants to pass what's called a new poor law through Commons.
Mm-hmm.
And Commons doesn't see it as their business to create work. It's hard to read that section and not think you're touching on a very contemporary debate.
Yes, indeed. All over England, rural unemployment and consequent poverty and disorder are endemic problems. So Cromwell is saying, what are the causes of poverty? It's that people don't have work. They turn to law-breaking when they can't feed their families. What can we do about this? The country needs an infrastructure. We need roads, bridges, harbours. We have men who need work. Let's put the two together. But the state will have to finance it. And the way he seemed to be proposing to finance it was by imposing income tax. But Parliament did not like that. They comprehensively trashed his measure. But he was in lots of ways a man ahead of his time. Thinking of the relationships between the state and society, it all seems startlingly modern.
You know, I'm having such a wonderful time reading your books about Thomas Cromwell. Is there any way you could prevent the end from happening? I don't want to see this guy's head on a stick, if I might put it that way.
Yes, wouldn't it be wonderful if you could get in like that and change things? I want to challenge the reader to stand in his shoes and say, if you were Thomas Cromwell, what would you have done? So that the reader sees the turning points and they can say, at that point, it just could have been different. But I myself think that Thomas Cromwell's end was written into the beginning. He was really in a no-win situation because his position was an affront to the nobility who thought they should be Henry's advisers. He was envied by those on an equal level with him. And to the common people, he was an object of suspicion. How had this low-born man got up to such an eminence? Well, it must be because he was a sorcerer. So he had no constituency. He had no family to back him. His only friend really was the king. And the moment the king turned against him, then it was all over. But the marvellous thing about it is that he managed to keep on winning for so long. And I hope the reader will take pleasure in watching him do so.
Hilary Mantel, her new novel. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The profession of teaching has come under fire in recent years. Teachers are blamed for low test scores, they're called lazy, even greedy. Most people assume their workday is short and their vacations are long. But teachers also have their defenders, perhaps none so passionate as Taylor Malley. He was once a full-time teacher. Now he calls himself a teacher poet. And he's just released a new book. It's called What Teachers Make, and it explains his journey from educator to advocate. Here's NPR's Lynn Neary.
Taylor Malley says he went to graduate school for poetry and came out a teacher. But during his years in the classroom, he never stopped writing poems. That came in handy after an unpleasant encounter with an obnoxious lawyer one night at a party.
He insulted me and the entire teaching profession by essentially saying that anyone who wanted to become a teacher obviously didn't have the intellectual capacity to be allowed to be one. And then he probably did ask me what my annual salary was. And I probably looked down at my shoes and said $27,500. And so it was probably a week or two later that I wrote the comeuppance that I wish I had been witty enough to deliver that night.
Malley poured his anger into a poem he called What Teachers Make. When he began performing it at Poetry Slams, he realized he had hit a nerve.
I mean, you're a teacher, Taylor. Be honest. What do you make? And I wish he hadn't done that. Ask me to be honest, because you see, I have a policy about honesty and ass-kicking, which is, if you ask for it, then I have to let you have it. You want to know what I make? I make kids work harder than they ever thought they could. I can make a C+ feel like a Congressional Medal of Honor.
If you've ever been to a poetry slam, you know that the highest scoring emotion is self-righteous indignation. How dare you judge me? So in that way, the poem What Teachers Make is a absolutely formulaic slam poem designed to allow me to get up on my soapbox and say, let me tell you what really makes me angry.
Let me break it down for you so you know what I say is true. I make a goddamn difference. Now, what about you?
The poem catapulted Malley into a new life. A video of his performance went viral. He started to get invitations to speak on behalf of teachers and in front of teachers. Without exactly meaning to, he became an advocate for teachers, a profession he truly believes doesn't get the respect it deserves.
The subtitle of What Teachers Make is, if things don't work out for you, you can always go to law school. And too often people have been saying that about teaching. You know, if you don't know what you want to do, you can always, you know, any idiot can teach for a while. That's just not true.
There are a lot of good teachers out there, says Malley, but the very best have a talent for making students want to do well.
The best teachers that I had were always the ones I never wanted to disappoint, and I worked harder than I thought I was capable. And one of the most important things that teachers teach students is you can work harder. You are mentally tougher than you think.
Malley is no longer a classroom teacher, but he still remembers those extraordinary moments when one of his students suddenly got it. He recalls one time when a student was struggling to understand a mathematical concept.
And this kid looked up at me and said, wait, are you saying that 13 and a half times 1/3 times 11 times 0 is going to be? And I said, what do you think? And he said, 0? And I went, yeah. And he went, oh, this changes everything. That's the great joy of being a teacher, when you realize that the lesson you have just sunk deeply into the clay of their brain has changed everything.
Malley writes about those moments in a poem called I Teach for the Fire.
I teach for the fire, the moment of ignition, the spark, the light bulb of cognition going on in the dark over the adolescent's head. Oh, beautiful incandescence, dazzling the dead air all around the room. He tries and he tries and he tries and boom, he gets it. And you can see it in his eyes. I teach for that moment.
But even Malley admits that a teacher can sometimes abuse the power he or she holds over a class, and he's been criticized for his tough, sometimes angry defense of the teaching profession. But he's not about to back off, and he sees no need to apologize.
The poem What Teachers Make is not without its detractors. This one person wrote to me and said, gee, Mr. Malley, you don't possibly have a teacher god complex, do you? And that was the first time I'd ever heard of that expression. So, yeah, I'm sure I have a teacher god complex.
Malley believes the best way to train teachers is to put them in a classroom and watch them teach. Instead of obsessing about our worst teachers, Malley says, we need to start a new national conversation about what it takes to be a great teacher and how to attract more people with that potential to our schools. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
One of the reasons many of us pick up a book is to inhabit someone else's life, and when that person is a celebrity, even better. Author Manuel Munoz knows the feeling. His favorite book is a fictional biography of one of history's most glamorous movie stars. It's called Blonde by Joyce Carol Oates, and he recommends it for our series You Must Read This.
Think Julianne Moore as Sarah Palin, or Meryl Streep as Margaret Thatcher. For an actor in a biopic, it's not really about developing character. We remember the public persona, so we know right away if the performance worked. But in historical novels, it's different. Novels give up the props, the hairdos, the prosthetic noses, and the accents. They aim for something different, interior life. The best and most audacious one is Blonde by Joyce Carol Oates, which examines the inner life of Marilyn Monroe. This book is fiction, not biography, but it's still hard to let go of what you know of Marilyn. Oates tries to kill that illusion in a note to her readers, but she knows that Monroe is a conundrum. She's a woman who was born under one name but died under another, an American fairy tale heroine who refuses to disappear. Blonde gives us her life and death, the rise and fall of her stardom. It's written in the language of tabloid and the privacy of diary. The novel is flamboyant and energetic. It assembles everything, from gossip to pinups, and it presents the life of a woman who is overshadowed by her on-screen persona. Oates knows what attracts us to the life of a star. We see humble beginnings, the unstable mother, and a series of adults, some kind, others manipulative. Then there's a foray into modeling, and the streak of luck that brings the bigger-than-life movie roles. Her cameo in All About Eve, or a major role in The Asphalt Jungle, and then her triumph in Some Like It Hot. Monroe's marriages to Arthur Miller and Joe DiMaggio are given wide space. They're called only the playwright and the ex-athlete, but that's where we see how she tried to become a self-determined woman, even when the men in her life wouldn't allow it. There's no spoiler here in discussing the end of the book. We witness the infamous birthday salute to President Kennedy, but we already sense the lurid, tragic conclusion. But the result is devastating, driven by a sense of shared intimacy with a star who remains in the end completely out of reach.
Manuel Munoz is the author of What You See in the Dark. He recommended Blonde by Joyce Carol Oates. You can comment on this essay at our website. Go to nprbooks.org and click on You Must Read This. There you'll also find other essays from authors including Lauren Groff, Seth Graham Smith, and National Book Award winner Jesmyn Ward.